tonight's question is there really an energy crisis? I've invited Rudy Edmond, our village geologist, to join us this evening and to start things off. So without further ado, Rudy.
Thank you, Mark. And I thought maybe one of the best ways I could introduce this was to maybe just read a paragraph or two or three that I've written within the last year. You know, when you write something, when you really have your neck out, because everybody's asked you from that point on, so at least what I want you to know is where I stand and what my feelings about this are, and then we can go from there. And I know that you have opinions as well, and you want everybody to have a chance to express themselves and to maybe ask questions of me that you want to take a pot shot at me, that's fine. I have had the opportunity of working for a major oil company for 18 years of my professional life, so I've been directly involved, and also I've had the request to request myself for the Augsburg Publishing House in terms of a little book that I was asked to write, and it's over on the bookshelf over in the store, so if any of you are interested in a later point, I may quote a little out of this. It's Sharing God's Gifts, and deals with the energy crisis as well as a number of other things. And I became concerned about this really when I was with the oil company. And at that point, it seemed to me that we all had a problem before us, but it really was not being recognized. And so when I went back to teaching after 18 years in the oil industry, I developed a course and titled it World Resources. And I've taught that course now for some 20 years. And it really deals with all the natural resources worldwide and tries to relate this to our society and to the problems of the future. So I suppose in some sense I'm a futurist, thinking mainly about what's happening down the pipe from here. And so I've written an article that appears in the Environment Times. And the Environment Times is really the organ for the National Association of Geology Teachers. So in a sense, I'm writing to my peers, but also to other people who may encounter them. But the title of this particular article is Natural Resources, Myths and Realities. What are the myths and what are the realities? Is the doomsday scenario a myth or a reality? For me, and a more important question is, what do we know about the raw materials that could be used to support essential systems and provide health, happiness, and necessities to humankind? Are the choices we make today closing off the flexibility of selecting viable options in the future? We have grown accustomed to a lifestyle in America that uses very large amounts of energy, metals, space, and land. Why not? Fuels have been cheap and abundant. Cultivating a taste for the newest model of a car or appliance made jobs for many, so naturally we moved to bigger things, to bigger homes, and to suburbia. Everything was going just great until the word shortage crept into our vocabulary. Some say shortages are contrived and are truly myths. Others argue our future is doomed. After 18 years in the oil patch as a professional geologist and the manager of an exploration production team for a major oil company, I became convinced that oil and gas would one day become a very dear commodity. Oil became the prime mover of our industrial effort can launch the United States into an era of affluence and power. Because oil and gas could be delivered cheaply by pipeline, petroleum took the place of coal as the prime source of cheap energy for factories, trains, and the automobile. There seemed to be a use for every barrel of oil that could be found. From the inside, however, the picture in the 1950s began to change. The cost of finding new oil and gas reserves in the USA started to climb. Why? Because the quality of drilling prospects deteriorated, more risky ventures had to be taken, and competition grew keener. It was a great time for the wildcatter and the small company to mount oil wells, and many were drilled. Exploring for oil is much like going fishing. There is no way to know in advance how lucky you're going to be. Often in the oil business, a glut of oil or gas has flooded the market, and down came the price, causing a lowering of incentives and profitability. The wildcat well that becomes a gusher makes the headlines, and the public learns little about the dry holes that cost as much to drill and outnumber the producers more than 10 times. The excitement of fishing is real, but the assurance of fish for dinner is a myth. And it's the same way in the oil business. There is no certain way of knowing what you're going to find. Energy is plentiful. And is that a myth or a well-established reality? Our Earth gives all of its energy from the sun, and our knowledge of life over the last 3 billion years strongly supports an output of radiant energy that is remarkably constant, and so on. And that, I think, by way of introduction, but tells you something of my background and something of my feeling about energy as a critical commodity in our life today and particularly for the future. And of course, the situation that has brought it to our attention really is the situation related to fossil fuels. And by the fossil fuels, I mean oil and coal and natural gas. And in recent times, these have been in the paper very much, and you all have opinions about this by now. There's no question that everybody in this room has thought very specifically about the topic. And I think before commenting further about this, I'd just like to open it up to you, because you have your own particular background and your own feelings about it. And what do you think? Do you really think that there is a crisis that relates to energy, now or in the future?
We are numb.
We're numb? Well, for what reason? Yeah.
I think that a lot of people can believe that there will be shortages of oil and all that. On one hand, that's true. But then on the other hand, I think they feel that the oil companies have used that to their advantage. And that it's too bad, because then that makes people tend to not want to believe that there is a crisis. Okay.
So, where do we go from there? If you don't want to believe it, then what? If we don't believe it.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, I believe that there is an energy crisis, but I also believe that the oil companies are using that to their advantage, and there's nothing that I can do about that. I have to buy their oil. If I want to drive my car, I have to buy their pay their price and what, you know. I don't know what I could do about it.
If you didn't buy their oil, they wouldn't produce it.
But that's not feasible. That isn't gonna happen. Yeah, well, everybody's not gonna just stop buying their oil.
When was oil discovered?
I don't know.
Well, over 100 years ago. But for that time, they never used oil.
Yeah, but people aren't gonna go back to the horse and buggy at this point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, we have an opinion that we're not going to go back to where we were before we found it. So that's one. Yeah.
My question to you probably is, and whether you can answer or not, I don't know, but why is petroleum, gas, for our cars, 50 cents a gallon cheaper in Canada than it is here?
Okay. And I guess why is it one third of the cost it is in Europe?
Right.
Well, why do we have $3 gasoline in Europe, $1.25 here, and roughly a dollar or a little less maybe in Canada?
I just came back from there. It averaged between 75 and 80 cents.
We were just up there too, so I know that's the situation. And how can there be that much difference worldwide? And what do you think about the justification for the difference? I feel personally, as you're asking me, that really we would be much better off in the country if the price of oil were $2 to $2.50 a gallon. Now, why? All right. I'll give you my opinion, and then let's talk about it. I think that if the price of oil were higher, then there would be a much greater emphasis placed on other sources of energy other than oil and gas and coal. And why would I want to save oil, gas, and coal? I think it's a tragedy that we have to burn our good oil and gas and even coal for space heating, for heating a house, or for heating anything, or for generating electricity. I think it's unfortunate that we're doing that, because the petroleum and the coal is so much more important as a base for chemicals and for synthetics and plastic and all of these other things that we could make out of oil and gas and fertilizer and even food that can be converted. So there are much better uses for oil and gas and coal than burning them. But the convenience is one of the things. So why the difference in the price of oil? In our own country, let's speak for our own country. The price of oil is kept down deliberately by congressional action. The price of petroleum in this country is controlled. And those controls were initiated, you see, back in prior to the crisis that came on as a result of the Persian Gulf shutdown, you see, when Iran and others began to deny us oil, then we all immediately, that drew our attention immediately. And of course, that's been the major problem. But prior to that time, the whole emphasis from the point of view of our Congress and our elected people, the people we send to Congress, is to protect the consumer. It's really to provide a cheap source of energy to the consumer, and the consumer then is encouraged to use as much of this as he wishes. There was no talk of conservation prior to the 70s, the early 70s, when oil became hard to get. But right now, the price what justification is there for a higher price? It takes a lot of money to replace the barrel of oil that's used today, and that's where the real problem is. And the problem is that we have drawn on an account here which really is going to exhaust. Let's look at it another way. Oil and gas in the Earth's crust is an inheritance from the past. It's accumulated there over millions and millions of years. And it's only been in the last 100 or 125 years that we have paid very much attention to it. And even coal, 200 years ago, was not really an important fuel. But with the industrial advance and revolution, this all came on as something that would move things very rapidly in the economy, and so it's been encouraged. Now, we're drawing on that without restriction except cost. And that's really the only deterrent to using it up as rapidly as we can. So my argument would be that the higher the price is, and then the more conservatively we're going to use it, and the longer it will last, and the more we can use it for other things. It'll also encourage us to develop solar energy and recycle various things, produce alcohol from various sources, and use the alternate sources of energy, the geothermal, solar, and things that are renewable. Yeah.
Well, I should say I don't agree that the congressional people do that at this point to protect the consumer. I think they're doing it to protect their jobs.
Well, sure.
If they were to legislate, you know, $2.50 gasoline, everybody that voted yes would get voted no on at the polls the next time they came up for election. That's why they don't raise the price.
Well, then who elects them?
Well, we do, but we don't know how they would.
How then does this really happen? Do we really vote then to keep the situation the way it is, or do we support somebody in Congress who would change it?
Well, I don't think the ones that would change it would have enough nerve to stand up and say. That many of them, maybe a few, but not very many are going to stand up and say, well, I want it to be $2.50 a gallon, you know.
Yeah, okay.
You're probably not going to do that either.
If you're in favor of limiting consumption of oil, why don't you advocate rationing rather than increased price so it won't bear so heavily on the poor and the less affluent?
Mm-hmm. All right, that's another way of doing it, and that's an alternate way to consider, and I think that is an alternate.
But rationing won't work.
Rationing won't work. Okay.
Why not? Why won't it?
I won't it. The mafia, for one thing, and our politicians, for another.
We're addressing only one aspect, though. We're addressing only one aspect of the consumption of oil. The biggest consumption of oil in this country is not the automobile; it is the power industry. Mm-hmm. When you look at the sources, you mentioned solar and geothermal. Mm-hmm. Those are two that are still in their infancy as far as the developing technology. Okay. There are two others that you did not mention, both of which are restricted by environmental constraints. One is nuclear, the other is hydro. Hydroelectric plants are being restricted in cases where we have endangered species, things like the snail darter down in Tennessee. There was also a small plant down in, a growing plant that was rare in its area that canceled another hydro project. And those are all very limited, but they are still sources, they're renewable resources of energy in the case of hydro, that we restrict ourselves artificially. So these people in the government have a very difficult problem because it's emotional when it gets into the subject of it's affecting the environment, and here we have these endangered species that we're doing away with. But we have to look at that as a luxury. Can we afford to protect that species at the expense of every other form?
All right, so anyone wish to respond to that?
Granted, there is an energy crisis, and it's not going to go away. It seems to me that, partially address your response. It seems to me that the government's response has been almost totally one of how can we maintain the present level of energy consumption through developing alternative means of energy, not, and probably politically it's a very unpopular stand to say, how can we use less energy, significantly less energy? How can we change our lifestyle so that we use less energy? And that seems to me that's something that, as Christians, we're called to, certainly to consider and make some hard choices. Not waiting for, you know, other means of forms of energy to be economically developed, to switch and say, well, let's keep using, you know, the same amount of energy but from other sources, but how can I live on less energy?
What do you recommend?
Mass transit a lot more than using our automobiles?
I'd recommend that we go to zero population increase and keep and stop letting people force us to take their unwashed hordes.
Ouch.
That's more than hordes.
People use energy.
And the population has increased in the last 30 years by 1 billion, from 3 to 4 billion.
I think some kind of population control is part of the answer. But I also think that we are called to look at ways that we can live using less energy, because we're still banking it away for future generations, even if we have a stable population in this year.
Okay, I see a hand over here.
Only question that comes to mind, if most of our energy, as this gentleman said, is used to generate power rather than convenience, and power is utilized to run industry, which creates jobs, mm-hmm. Utilizing less energy would inevitably result in less jobs and perhaps more hungry people.
If I respond to that, would there be fewer jobs?
I'll go back to it.
Oh, you want to go back? All right.
I guess I just want to make a personal comment in response to the wastefulness that we as people practice. I have no idea of any statistics, and you know, I just have no background in that way to respond, but being aware of wasteful practices that maybe I've exercised in the past and how some of my ways can change to has probably at times brought about a little bit of resentment, but also a feeling of pride. I know I changed, you know, driving habits, consumption of gasoline, electricity, all kinds of things to some degree, and that really has created a sense of pride in me. And I think if we are aware of our earth and stating parts of it, we will take that if we do make that.
From a Christian point of view, that would be good stewardship.
I think so, yeah.
One of our natural gifts that we're given, and God created gifts.
Okay. Do geologists have any mathematical system determining how many people will exercise self-restraint on their own volition, and how many will do it only when they're forced to?
Well, I think that we all have a pretty good opinion about that. That is there any real chance that we can do this as rational human beings rather than human beings under pressure? Really, that's what you're asking. In other words, can you make a change in lifestyle or in conservation without it being a forced change? And the force would come from whatever, more cost, more inconvenience, more something that affects your life personally, but doesn't bring pressure on you? Will you change rationally? And I think that's really a very basic question at this point.
I don't know of any culture or civilization that has voluntarily done that on a large scale.
Does anybody know of any? I don't know of any either. And I think, what does that say for us? Does it say that we're not really going to look at this problem until it's critical? And the question, I guess, that's really raised, is this a crisis? Are we at the crisis point yet?
I would imagine that the 1 million automobile workers think it's a crisis point.
People in Detroit probably have very fixed opinion about this. True. How many automobiles do we have running today? You have a pretty good idea in your mind? Automobiles and light trucks that people use, you know, for transportation.
About 100 million, isn't it?
Yeah, 125 is the latest figure I've seen. 125 million light cars and automobiles. How many of you know neighbors who have less than two cars? Or yourself. Some have three. But California, that's an adult is supposed to have a car. If there are three adults in the family, why, you each need a car. That's kind of the pattern.
I think it's really a bum rap for us to get blamed for the way we live. And for the last, I don't know how many years, indirectly through our government, through our culture, through Madison Avenue, we've been urged to consume. When we live in Seattle, you get a special rate. The more electricity you use, you have an all-electric rate. It was to your advantage putting electric heat and electric hot water and so on. And we bought European cars because we liked them, but they got better miles. And we were doing some things a long time ago for our own reasons that turned out to be good later on. But I guess I kind of resent, there's been a lack of leadership in government and industry all along. It's been very irresponsible. And now that things are running low, all of a sudden I'm supposed to turn down my heat way down. And in a portion of our area, they just passed an ordinance that prohibits electric heat in any new construction, and people are screaming because it's unfair. You know, they've been pushing, and now all of a sudden you can't do that. And that leaves a lot of people really, you know, up the creek. So, you know, we live in the suburbs. There isn't a bus within 2 miles. It's pretty unrealistic to say take mass transit if your whole community's been designed for driving everywhere, 5 miles to anything. I think bailing out Chrysler, and nobody wants to buy Detroit cars now because they get such a falling mileage. You know, and so what are we doing? Instead of quitting making them, we're buoying up this failing corporation. That to me is just irresponsible, and I don't like to take the blame for it personally. I think personal conservation is very important, but I think that there's been a real lack of leadership.
Okay.
Well, I like the way a lot of things have been expressed, because it's tending to come along the line that I've been thinking about this for a long time, that it's really a social problem. In fact, I think the way you stated some of the questions has led this way. That what is really the question is, how can we get people without putting unreasonable pressure on them to make the necessary changes so that we won't have some time, maybe in the future, sometime have to have a revolutionary change which will hurt and maybe kill a lot of people. In other words, we want to have social change. We want to have change that will not hurt and kill a lot of people. At least from the Christian point of view, that should be our outlook. And so, to me, I've always been asking this question, looking at myself, well, what are you going to do about it, Frank? What am I personally going to do about it? And this has to be my place. We're just talking about
you know, we felt like we got put into some things. I also want to put in direct what they call photovoltaic conversion, which is it's solar panels that don't heat water but directly make electricity.
Right.
They're very expensive at this time, but from time to time, experimental cells are sold off at surplus at rather reasonable prices. And certain people that are investigating this are right on the verge of a breakthrough that will dramatically lower the price. They say down to 20% of what it is now. So, as a social thing, the people of the United States of America are right on the verge, and I think, I'll go right back to your first suggestion, I think it has to get to where the prices are unbearable. But about the time the prices become unbearable, the solutions will be there. The solutions are already there, maybe, but they aren't in place and in use. And I feel as an individual responsibility to try to do something along that line. I would like to have, I have a long-term goal, if I continue to live in the same society, in the same place, to get independent of the power line. And I believe it can be done.
Okay.
Can you just think something of me that we've talked about before, and that's the number of improvements that you can make to your house to save energy.
Oh,
and
my God,
the cost involved.
First thing was the wood burning stove.
Yeah. Everything from, you know, special shower heads to, I don't know what.
We did that.
And you add it all up and it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Three times we bought shower heads together.
Yeah. We've talked about things like that, like whether we should get a car that got better mileage, and we've gotten figured out how much that was going to cost us to get better mileage.
Mm-hmm.
We said, silly, we, you know, it takes 10 years to pay for it. We feel kind of trapped.
Okay. Any other comments?
Yes. We were off at a little different line here a moment ago that I'd like to comment on. I don't think that it's so much a crisis of energy as it is a crisis in management, a crisis in courage, and a crisis in leadership, particularly in our federal government. I've been reading the last couple of things that I got out of the library. It's by William Simon, who's former Secretary of Treasury.
Right, that's a very good book.
I think so. He was named as Nixon's so-called energy czar when the first Arab oil blockade occurred.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the Treasury at that point. He was brought out and set up to run the government's policy and become chief allocator and so on. It's quite fascinating, this chapter on how he steeped himself, learning about the business and what was going on. And he summarized a few things that he tried to pound in the heads of a bunch of very thick congressional people. He summarized a few things there. I want to read a couple of things. On the subject of coal, he said, we have half of all the coal reserves in the non-communist world, of which at least 425 billion tons are immediately recoverable, and at 1973 levels of consumption, we would have enough coal for 800 years. Natural gas, we have potential natural gas reserves of 920 trillion cubic feet, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, enough for 40 to 50 years. At 1972 rates of consumption. And then he did talk about reserves and so on of oil, but he didn't give an equivalent. But I obviously think that the term on oil was much more limited compared to gas and coal. He said on nuclear, we are the world's technological pioneers in nuclear energy production, which in its various forms can yield limitless energy. And I think what he was saying was it's all there. It's the courage to get into and use it. And his basic theme is that the government has been meddling in it so badly, downward price controls and so on over the years, that what he believes in a free market system would bring these solutions forward. And we would have all the energy we needed.
See, until just now, we've decontrolled. There's a decontrol placed on oil over a three-year period. It's gradually coming out from under this protected price, you see, where it will rise to the world market price. And we'll have the opportunity for the first time, you see. Prior to this time, we've had control of both the price of oil and the price of gas. And the price of gas has been held very, very low. In fact, it was artificially much lower than, in terms of BTU, the price of oil.
Natural gas. Excuse me, he commented on that, and he said that something like four states produce the majority of natural gas in the country, but the government controls interstate production of it at the control levels. So the gas, the natural gas, is consumed primarily in the states where they're allowed to charge higher prices.
Yes.
He mentions in that book the results of some of the government policies. One of the two that I noticed most strongly, one was that the number of oil wells we're drilling per year is one half of what it was 8 years ago. Because there's a disincentive to explore for oil when your price is artificially held lower than it would be in a free market system. The second was, in 1957, when these oil controls went into effect, part of them included a disincentive for the importation of unrefined oil and an incentive for refined oil product coming from abroad. The result was we've had a tremendous stagnation in the development of new refining capacity in this country. The result is we do not have the refining capacity to increase our own domestic production until just now, when finally the government is reluctantly starting to get out of the picture.
Yeah, that's happening, and also drilling now. The drilling this year will be up a considerable amount, 15% increase in drilling for oil this year over last year. That's strictly the result of higher price. And the government getting hands off to a certain degree. This is, I think, one of the major political issues that we face in the presidential election as well, and you're hearing about it from various sources.
Another political aspect of that, and this gentleman mentioned coal as being a very large resource, we get back into pork barrel politics. When you consider that the Western coals are a low sulfur coal, and yet you're still forced to do the stack scrubbers and the rest that they need to remove sulfur from that isn't there, you have imposed an artificial constraint. And when you go further and you require that in order to protect the miners in a particular state, that the utilities in that state not be allowed to buy coal from adjoining states that's cheaper, you're not looking at the problem from a whole country. It's like, for example, saying that the South needs water and the Northwest has it, we shouldn't therefore send it down there, you know, move the people up here. They get to be very emotional arguments on these kinds of things, and it's region against region rather than a nation as a whole working a problem.
Yes?
May I comment a little bit more on that coal while we're on that?
Okay.
We have a friend who works on the project on Fort Lewis property for coal gasification, the pilot plant. And he said that as an example of what government meddling or any interference can do, they deliberately set the plant on federal property for the federal program. They're taking coal from Pennsylvania, bringing it all the way out here to go through this process of coal gasification. And then they're taking the product to somewhere in the Midwest. In other words, they're deliberately imposing a tremendous double transportation on it that's unrealistic, when in fact there's plenty of coal available in the Northwest to do that project, or that plant could have been built, you know, as an alternative in Pennsylvania. So, I mean, either way, it's definitely being limited economically so that it won't look too good on paper.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's what he said. I don't know whether that's true or not. And I want to add one other thing to it, that it used to be said that coal was not good because it couldn't be sent through pipelines, and however, that's not true anymore. With some conversion and modification, existing pipelines can be used to transmit what they call slurry.
Slurry coal, yes, they've experimented with this. It's,
now, that doesn't mean they can use the same one they use for oil, because you have to convert it, you know, change it.
Okay.
And it takes water.
I have the feeling that the oil companies still are sort of the bad guys in the operation. I had the opportunity to do the national exhibit for the Bureau of Mines and work with Roger Morton, and the head of the Bureau of Mines.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in time, they said that 20 to 30 years ago, they could degasify the, or whatever the word is, the coal and make oil at a much cheaper rate. The reason I did the Bureau of Mine display is because at that time the oil companies owned all the coal companies and they didn't want to be bad guys, and so they asked Roger to take the process and make it look good. You know, minerals are for the people. And it is my contention or thought, in fact I know of another group now from Australia that have bought large holdings in Canada and are going down for 2 mile drilling episodes of oil where they maintain there's huge quantities of oil. They're spending $20-30 million to try, which is a drop in the bucket, but their contention is that the large oil companies really don't want to broadcast the fact that there's large oil reserves deep, that it's cheaper to drill higher and they can buy cheaper from the east. So my contention is that the oil companies own the coal companies and they're not really trying, and two, they do have other methods of digging deeper. And I think Mobil Oil just now recently has a deep oil well in Pennsylvania or something?
Alabama.
Is that true, or I mean, having once worked with it?
Yeah, within the last year, we've established new drilling records in terms of depth. So now that production is coming from more than 26,000 feet below the surface, we're drilling that deep, and the cost of these wells are in the millions of dollars. And we've also gotten better techniques in locating places where oil might be found. And the great overthrust belt of the mountains is the big hope now among the oil companies at great depth. And I just came from a convention in Denver where the American Association of Petroleum Geologists, they were devoting their whole conference really to a consideration of these possibilities. And I think it's not true that they are not looking for these big supplies. They are. And I think they are spending their money to try to find these. It's to their advantage to do that. And they are doing it. So, and the question really is what they're really going to find. It's just like I said, when you go fishing, you know, you don't know for sure. And at least to the present, the best way of our looking at it is what the track record of the oil companies worldwide is. It's in terms of our own reserves in the United States of America, they have been going downhill for the last 10 years, from 1970 to 1980. We reached our peak in reserves in 1970. That's when Alaska was discovered, Prudhoe Bay. And that increased our reserves by 10 billion barrels. And so that brought it up to almost 40 billion barrels. Now that in 10 years, the production, that is the reserve that we have to produce, what's left now, is only 30 billion barrels. And we now have Alaska on full stream. And Alaska provided a 10 billion barrel jump. And we have now, in the last year and a half, 2 years, produced 1 billion out of that 10. And they have not found additional reserves in Alaska. So if the trend continues, you see, for the next 10, 15 years, that field is depleted. You know, that we have nine. We discovered 10, we've produced 1 billion, we have 9 left. And at the rate of production right now, it'll continue to go right on down, and all of the domestic reserves in the lower 48 states are all going downhill, in spite of all the money that's spent to find new reserves.
I suggest Wes Priebe write a letter to them so they get to their depleted as Holden was, and maybe we can have an attachment of the Prudhoe Bay of Lisbon 20 years from now.
Okay? Yes?
One of the things that you haven't touched on is renewable resources. Wood waste, and I only know of one company that's producing alcohol from those wastes, and that's Georgia-Pacific. And I feel that if the price were higher, more companies would be into it. And we might as well take a lesson from Europe. You go over there, you see a lot of people walking, and you see a lot of people riding bicycles, and I've only seen two big gas hogs in all my, well, I went to Denmark, Switzerland, Germany, and London, and I only saw two big cars over there. And I, another thing, I think controlling the population, it is my feeling that our welfare system needs overhauling. Second, income tax wise, a person with a half dozen children gets a greater deduction than I do with one, and that's not right. He gets more from it than I do because his children have all of the advantages of their schools and everything that mine does, but he has six and I have one. That's just a classic example. But I think we are missing the boat when we do not raise the price, use a lot of wood waste that's not going up into smoke. When you rejuvenate a piece of ground, I burned enough slag last year to supply the whole city of Shelton in energy.
You know, in looking at it worldwide, the biggest energy shortage at the present time worldwide is wood. That's the most critical shortage we have at the present worldwide. Because, you see, most of the world doesn't use very much petroleum or gas. So when you take a look at the total population, India uses very little oil, almost none. And they don't even have wood. So when you look at the third world, the biggest crisis is really in firewood because of the increase in population.
We use wood, we'll solve that problem. We'll increase the carbon dioxide levels, get rid of the recycling of oxygen, and bring down the population.
James, that's one of the wastes.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, that's right. So that's another whole topic.
Right. Early on, when you were giving us some of the background, a number of things you said can be tied in. You said that the radiation from the sun can be shown in a long past history to be relatively constant. And we might add to that that the fossil fuels in the ground are a stored form of that radiant energy from the sun, in a way of speaking. And I have no doubt that, you know, even with all the remarkable things done in exploration, that these things are in fact exhaustible and that they will run out someday. And I'd like to say it may be a funny sounding thing, but yes, I believe there's an energy crisis, and I kind of like the fact that this is causing a pinch and causing prices to go up. Because getting back to this thing about the radiant energy of the sun, I saw in a recent article in Cognitive Science or Cognitive Mechanics, I get them mixed up, that on my house, on my roof, on the coldest day of the winter, the shortest day of the winter, during just 4 or 5 hours of daylight, in the latitude at which I live, which is north of here a bit, I believe, there is enough energy falling there, if I were collecting it, to take care for that 24-hour period, our need for hot water, space heat, and light, and cooking in that house, if we only were collecting it.
Yeah. I hope you'll all have a chance to at least see the solar panels we have up here on the hospital. They have just been installed, and they're just now in operation. They're providing hot water for our laundry and saving us a lot of fuel. We'd have even a worse energy crisis than we had this morning. We had a minor crisis this morning. The electricity went off, and I guess we're being told that by tomorrow we're going to have some rules or some restrictions that we'll have to try to live with because we can't generate enough electricity. Well, that's taking some of the electricity. We're not using as much electricity because we're using the solar energy. And I hope that you'll have a chance to go up, put your hand on the pipe and really feel that, and that's really renewable. It's not costing us beyond this.
Yeah, what I was getting at is that at the current time, in order for me to gain what would save me from the power line, $200 a year, it would cost me $2,000, which means it takes 10 years to pay it off.
That,
if they would mass produce that very same item to where I could buy it for $200, then it would only take 1 year to pay it off. So what I'm after is a little bit cheaper equipment. I can't get equipment cheaper.
It's going to have to be government supported in some way to get people to really get started into it. That's one of the big problems.
What would Simon say about that? That New Testament prophet of Ayn Rand's gospel.
I hope I wasn't commenting on his gospel. I have to enjoy it, and I believe it.
He's a giggle every page.
Pardon me?
He's a giggle every page.
Okay.
Comment?
Well, a lot of things are flashing through my mind, but one of the reasons that we come to Holden, since we were here the first time, and the question last year was how much is enough, is to be reinforced, to be one family of that culture that you talked about that prevents the, before the crisis comes. Like, I've always believed that as a Christian, it's a responsibility not to wait till the system hands me a dilemma that wasn't in balance with God and nature in the first place, and that because I seek to be in tune with God, I would also seek to keep a balance. And I'm not there yet by any means, but when you asked about the neighbors with two cars, we're the only family in a couple of, I don't know how many blocks, that only have one car. We're the only family that has a fireplace insert, the only family that cut down on sugar. And they went through a lot of criticism when the neighbor kids found out that we were doing things differently. But I think if Christians educate themselves the way we do here and the way many churches are, and they are obviously doing things differently like this man over here, that makes a tremendous difference. And why do I need a bath every day? Why do I have to change my clothes every day? Why do I have to go so fast to go somewhere? You know, all these questions that make a difference.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt to just read another paragraph here. In this little booklet, Sharing God's Gifts, the chapter is When the Well Runs Dry. And an ideal, first of all, is water. And then with air, because the well can run dry with clean air as well. Then with soil, and then other shortages, including energy. The impending energy shortage is a critical problem. Our current economy, jobs, standard of living, and lifestyle depend on energy from oil and gas. Oil and gas fields in the United States now provide only 53% of what we consume, and we are not geared up to substitute coal, nuclear, or solar energy to make up the increasing shortage. We consume more energy than we need. This is borne out by a comparison with Scandinavia and other European countries, where the use per person is about half of what it is in the United States. They keep consumption down by using smaller cars, more mass transportation, recycling in industry, and having lower temperatures and better insulation in their home. More of the incentive to save energy in Europe is the fact that it costs more. And gasoline, for example, costs about three times what it costs in the United States. Our economy is geared to the automobile and a cheap source of energy. By congressional action, our reserves of oil and gas are being produced and sold below the cost of replacement. I think that's the critical point. And this policy encourages more consumption and discourages the development of solar energy and other forms of alternate energy, including coal. Cheap fuel, you see, has really brought this all together. And then this final paragraph. It is time for a change in our stewardship concept and pattern. We have tried to cure the ills of humankind by advocating a higher standard of living measured in material things and comfort beyond our needs. The new stewardship must get us back to a servant relationship, carefully tending the whole of creation as managers for the God who has provided all.
That's a beautiful book.
And it's exactly 10 o'clock, so you were very timely.
Oh, well.
Thank you very much. Thank all of you.